Are you ready for some soundbite, clear scriptural answers for some of the toughest questions the church is facing today?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey friends, Michael Brown here. I've got a very special broadcast that I hope you'll be able to go back to time and time again. I believe you'll find it helpful, fruitful. I believe that as we break things down into bite-sized form and then expand on it, it will help you to be able to communicate some of the most difficult issues that the church is facing. Hey, let's face the fact that we've got to break everything down these days into soundbite form. Let's recognize the fact that not everyone is going to sit through a long discussion or read, let alone 100 pages. Forget about 1,000 pages. How about a page? How about a paragraph? So if we can break things down and make them as simple and clear as possible, I believe then, when we have someone's attention, then when we've given them the core of the argument, the core of the issue, we'll be able to expand on it and say, all right, now let me explain further. What am I talking about? Well, it's Wednesday, Worldview Wednesday. We often focus on issues having to do with morality, with the culture, but I want to combine that with theology today on The Line of Fire. I've got a lot to cover. I'll be able to take your calls in coming days for clarification and interaction. You can always write to us with questions through the website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Just click on contact to write to us. But I want to pack in as much as I possibly can. Now, if you have my book, Can You Be Gay and Christian?, we tackle some of the fundamental issues I want to talk to you about. If not for the fact that we get asked these questions day and night, if not for the fact that the church is being confronted with these day and night, if not for the fact, I just saw another reviewer of my book, Can You Be Gay and Christian, who said, this is going to be the great question that is confronting the church today. If not for that, I wouldn't take so much time to break these things down in this way. But again, I feel it's important that we do it. If you want more information, I recommend my book, Can You Be Gay and Christian? That, in turn, will refer you to other major studies that will be of help to you. And in the 10 chapters of that book, I break down the arguments into, oh, just a line or two. Here is the argument. Here's our response. Today, on the broadcast, I'm going to break it down even more. Now, again, it doesn't mean that we dumb down the truth. It doesn't mean that we water down the truth. It means that we find ways to simplify our communication. Look, this is a generation that's used to tweeting, that's used to texting, that's used to short little phrases. Every generation has had phrases that it likes. Look, if you go back to the days of Benjamin Franklin and his little aphorisms, his wise sayings, and I can't tell you how many times I'll be hurrying to do something, and then it takes more time, and in the back of my head, I hear the words, haste makes waste. So even in a day when Americans operated at a slower pace and were much more given to reflection and deep thinking, these little proverbial sayings, these sound bites, so to say, were useful. But today, we have a generation that often finds it difficult to sit and think through issues critically. And when sound bites and tweets often rule the day, we need to simplify as much as possible. So that's what we're going to do on the broadcast. And of course, all of this will be online. So whatever you miss, you'll be able to go back to later on. And just go to our website, click on Latest Audio to hear the show in its entirety.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire broadcast. Hey, would you please keep me in prayer? A little bit later this week, I will be in the Philippines, God willing, together with some of our key fire leadership team, pouring into our missionaries there. Some of them have been serving well over a decade in the Far East and Asia, making an incredible impact for the gospel on so many different fronts, from church planting to making disciples to going into outlying districts of the poor and the hurting, to feeding orphans, housing orphans, feeding needy children, combating human trafficking, standing for pro-life, doing so much in these nations around the world. So be praying for us for maximum impact on the time together. And interestingly enough, while there, I have been asked to speak at a pastor's gathering on two subjects: the dangers of hypergrace, because churches in the Philippines are having to deal with this, and the subject of gay activism and can you be gay and Christian. That is scheduled for Sunday over the weekend before heading back. Today's broadcast, we're giving you soundbite answers to some of the challenges that we often get in terms of our stance on the Bible and homosexual practice. But let me say, as much as I'll give you clear and simple statements, I want to urge you to go to the Lord to ask Him for His heart, His mercy, His compassion, that you would remember how merciful He's been to you, how long-suffering He's been in His dealings with you, and that you would extend that same mercy and long-suffering to others. So while these short statements will be of help to you, not only must they be grounded in the larger teaching of the Word, but they also must be grounded in the love of God. If you read my book, Can You Be Gay and Christian, from the opening pages of the first chapter, you'll recognize it was written with a considerable amount of pain, because I do not want to hurt those who've been hurt already. I do not want to push away those who've already been pushed away many times by the church in our insensitivity. So pray for the compassion and mercy of God to flood your heart and to be joined with the truth of God's word. Grace and truth go hand in hand. Well, often when the conversation comes up about homosexual practice, many Christians assume slam dunk answer, no answer against this, and they give this verse as if they haven't thought through the potential objections and don't know the objections that are raised, and they simply quote Leviticus 18:22 and say it's an abomination for man to lie with a man the way he lies with a woman. Now, if you've ever interacted with anyone about this, here's the objection that you'll hear. Remember, we're quoting Leviticus. Well, do you eat shellfish? Do you keep the dietary laws? Do you live by all the other laws in Leviticus? What about all the other things that are called abomination in Leviticus? So how do we respond? Let me give you several soundbite responses. Number one, God gave Israel certain laws to keep them separate from the nations, such as the dietary laws and the laws against sowing two different types of seed in the field. He gave Israel other laws that were universal prohibitions for all people, such as the prohibitions against murder. The prohibition against homosexual practice is one of those universal prohibitions. So let's boil it down even more simply. God gave Israel certain laws to keep them separate from the nations that are not applicable to believers of all time, for all time. And God gave Israel certain laws that were based on eternal moral principles that are applicable to all believers for all time. Now, how do we know where Leviticus 18 fits? That's the first thing. So let's expand on the answer first in terms of my soundbite answer, and then I'll tell you how we know that Leviticus 18 is one of those laws, the prohibition on homosexual practice, that applies to all believers for all time. First thing, when we look at the biblical text, we recognize that our convenient distinctions that we make, there's some laws that are ceremonial, some moral, and some civil. We may make that distinction, but they're all woven together in the Pentateuch, in the legal portions of the Pentateuch, of the Torah, of the five books of Moses. And even though we might put them in those different categories, they're all mixed together. It's like you go to the grocery store and you've got produce in one section, and then following that you've got garbage bags, and then after that you've got more produce, then you've got cereal aisle, then you've got meat, but it's all mixed together, and it alternates from row to row, and even though you can separate them theoretically, they're all woven together. So God gave this to Israel as a whole, but when we come to the New Testament, we see that distinctions are made. We see that Jesus explains, for example, in Matthew 15 and Mark 7, that what comes into our mouth doesn't defile us spiritually. It's what comes out of our heart that defiles us spiritually. We see that dietary laws were not universally given to Gentile believers in the New Testament. And you can also make the case from the New Testament that for the sake of the gospel, you could eat unclean food. In other words, if you were a Jewish believer and you were living by the law and you went to share the gospel with some tribal group and they serve you pork, that in order to build relationship with them and preach the gospel to them, that you eat that pork. Now, on the flip side, if they said, to prove that you are really sincere, we want you to kill this person that we've taken prisoner from another tribe. No, you don't do that, because that's a universal moral prohibition. So to repeat the soundbite, God gave certain laws to Israel to keep them separate from the nation, such as dietary laws, and he gave other laws that were universal prohibitions for all people for all time. How do we know where Leviticus 18 fits? Well, it's very simple. We read the whole chapter. And when we read the whole chapter, we see that God dealt with the pagan nations. God judged the Egyptians and the Canaanites for committing these very sins. If he dealt with pagan nations for committing these sins, and he told Israel, don't do what they do, or otherwise you'll be treated the same way they were treated, then you realize, oh, okay, this is not just something God gave Israel. God did not judge the Egyptians and the Canaanites for eating pork, but he judged Israel for eating pork, although there was no death penalty associated with it or anything like that, where there was a death penalty associated with homosexual practice. That's how serious a violation it was in God's sight. So we see a great difference there. Just read the chapter from beginning to end. And if someone raises it, say, let's just read it from beginning to end. Then someone says, yeah, but that word abomination is just used for things that are ritually impure. It had nothing to do with moral impurity. Soundbite answer. The Hebrew word abomination often referred to that which was morally detestable, and sexual acts that were forbidden were morally detestable. And in my book, Can You Be Gay and Christian, I give lists of verses where the Hebrew word toeva refers to something that is morally detestable. Someone says, yeah, but that's used about food laws too. That word or similar word is used about food laws. Ah, when God gave the food laws to Israel, read Leviticus 11 and read Deuteronomy 14, you find this expression, this food or that food is detestable for you. In other words, it is not universally detestable for all people. It is not universally detestable that no one can eat a certain food. They eat shellfish, it's an abomination. No, that was an abomination for the people of Israel. Now, let's just think this through one more moment. If you say, well, we can't just use Leviticus and apply it to ourselves. Well, I have a question then. On what basis is incest forbidden according to the Bible. The New Testament doesn't address it directly. There's one related case in 1 Corinthians 5, and that's a case where apparently a man, when his father died, he then married his father's widow. But you do not have otherwise universal statements about incest through the rest of the Bible. If you cut out Leviticus 18, where's the prohibition against incest? Where, pray tell, then, is the prohibition against bestiality and other sins? Someone says, yeah, but it also says that it's forbidden for man to have sexual relations with his wife during her menstrual period. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree, that's wrong. Now, there's not a death penalty associated with it, but it's laid out as wrong. In fact, it's laid out as something universally wrong. So, yeah, I have no problem saying I agree with that. There's my soundbite answer. I'll come back, summarize things about Leviticus 18, and then get on with some other objections, giving you soundbite answers today.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
This is a special broadcast on the Line of Fire. It's a special equipping day. It's a day where I am functioning, especially in a teaching mode, to help you have simple answers for some of the primary objections that are being raised today in terms of the Bible and homosexual practice. If you miss any part of the broadcast, go to my website, AskDrBrown, askdrbrown.org, and click on Latest Audio in order to listen to the show in its entirety. And feel free to download it and share it with your friends. So we've just looked at Leviticus 18. We've tackled the objection to Leviticus 18:22. Which, by the way, is repeated with a penalty in Leviticus 20:13, where Moses teaches, the Pentateuch teaches, that it's an abomination, it's detestable for a man to lie with a man the way a man lies with a woman. We understand this to be a fundamental violation of God's creative order and of his purpose for male and female. The text says nothing about issues of patriarchy. The text says nothing about, well, a man can't be in a woman's position in society because that lowers him. It's more fundamental than that in the text. And there are also prohibitions against other sins, including incest, a long list of that. As I said in the last segment, if you take Leviticus 18 out of the picture, where's the prohibition against incest? And when the New Testament reinforces the prohibition against porneia, which is all forms of sexual immorality, including incest, everything outside of male-female union in marriage, when that's reinforced for Gentile believers in Acts 15, it surely includes the teaching about incest in Acts 18. Otherwise, if you say, well, that doesn't apply to us today, well, then where is the prohibition against incest? There are countries where incest is legal. If you lived in one of those countries, would you say, well, the Bible's not against it because the law is outdated? No. To repeat, God gave certain laws to Israel to keep them separate from the nations, like dietary laws, and he gave other laws that were based on universal principles. How do we know Leviticus 18 is one of those universal principles? A, because the text lays it out plainly, and it says that God judged the pagan nations for these same sins. And B, something I didn't get to in the last segment, it is reiterated in the New Testament. If I see something laid out in the law of Moses, which is now reiterated in the New Testament, then I know it still applies. Not that we are under the law of Moses, but that the law of Moses contains universal principles for all peoples, and those are reiterated in the New Testament writings, and those are part of the new and better covenant that God writes on our hearts. As to the objection that the Hebrew word toevah does not mean a moral abomination, something morally detestable, but only ritual, something that is ritually detestable, well, actually, other sins in Leviticus 18, including adultery, including burning one's child to the god Molech, those are included as toevot, detestable things in Leviticus 18. Are you going to say it's only ritually detestable? All right, let's think for a moment about Sodom and Gomorrah. We are told that the sin of Sodom was not homosexual practice, but rather inhospitality, which was manifest ultimately in the attempted gang rape of the angelic messengers whom the men of Sodom just thought were humans, were men, not recognizing they were angelic beings. I don't think it would have stopped them from their desires, but in terms of what they wanted to do. Now, it does say in the New Testament that they pursued strange flesh. Does that mean strange flesh as far as angels? Does it mean strange flesh in terms of men having sex with other men? That can be debated, all right? Some scholars would come down strongly either way on that. Let's just say that can be debated. And I'll get to my soundbite answer in a moment. What about Ezekiel 16 that says the sin of Sodom was they were overfed and they didn't care for the poor? Why not mention homosexual practice there? Oh, well, actually, it ends by saying they committed toevah, which is the exact same language of Leviticus 18 that it is committing toevah for man to lie with a man. It's committing an abomination. Isn't that interesting? What's my soundbite answer to the sin of Sodom based on Genesis 19 and Ezekiel 16? Are you ready? We're going to make this really simple, and I'm not going to get into a lengthy discussion over here on the air because there are other passages that are actually more important. My simple answer is this. While we cannot say that homosexual practice was the principal sin of Sodom, we can say that their sinful state expressed itself in rampant homosexual practice. That we can say. That's what the text does say. You say, yeah, but it was a way to humiliate a stranger and so on. True. That's part of it. And it remains in Middle Eastern culture to this day that by abusing a man, sodomizing a man especially, it is a humiliating, subjugating act. I don't doubt that that was part of it. But I simply would say this, that the manifestation of the sin of Sodom and a reason that the text tells us this story is to show how depraved they had become. So, Ezekiel 16 makes clear that the sin of Sodom was not simply homosexual practice or even primarily homosexual practice, but that the manifestation of their complacency, their laziness, their carnality, their greed, their lack of care for the poor and the needy was manifest in the fact that they committed abomination using the very language of Leviticus 18. And what was the abomination? It was their rampant sexual immorality expressed in a desire to commit an act of homosexual rape. Soundbite. Sodom was not primarily destroyed for the sin of homosexuality, but rampant homosexual practice. Sexual immorality out of control was a manifestation of Sodom's sin. All right, friends, I've only got a minute before the break, but this is a special broadcast designed to equip you. If you appreciate what we're doing, if you want to hold our hands up as we're doing it, if you want to amplify my voice, say, hey, Mike, we want to stand with you so you can help equip and teach many, many more, then why not join us and partner with us as a torchbearer? Go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. You'll see it right on the homepage, the first or second slide that comes up. Partner with us. My thank you gift will be a complete copy of the Tree of Life version of the Scriptures, hardcover, the complete Bible by a team of Messianic Jewish scholars, a $30 value. That's my thank you gift for partnering with us. Or call 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the line of fire. I cannot express to you the joy I have to be on the radio with you. So thank you for joining us so that this joy can be shared together. This is a special equipping broadcast. I'm putting on my teacher of the word hat, my professor hat, but trying to simplify things as much as I can. How do we respond to the objections that people raise against our teaching on the Bible and homosexual practices? I said earlier in the broadcast, I'm giving you sound bites and then expanding on them, but I'm also doing my best to remind you that everything we say must be bathed with compassion and the love of God and the long-suffering of Jesus as we reach out to those who identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, as we reach out to those who struggle with same-sex attraction or who celebrate same-sex attraction. What about the objection that Piers Morgan raised to me? Show me one place in the Bible where Jesus said a single word about homosexual practice, about being gay. If it was so important, show me where Jesus addressed it. Soundbite answer. First, it's dangerous to use an argument from silence. Jesus did not renounce wife beating by name or bestiality by name. Yet we don't think that those things were unimportant to him, or we don't think that those things were not proscribed and prohibited by him. We don't say, well, because he didn't mention it, it must be okay. That would be nonsense. So again, first soundbite answer, the argument from silence is dangerous. Just because Jesus didn't mention something by name doesn't mean it wasn't important. That's part one. Part two. Actually, although Jesus did not mention homosexual practice by name, he addressed it plainly in at least three different passages. Again, that's your soundbite answer. That's what I told Piers Morgan. He challenged me to give him one verse. I gave him three verses. Let me say it once more. Jesus addresses the issue of homosexual practice at least three different ways. Now I'll expand on it. Number one, in Matthew 7, beginning in verse 17, he says he didn't come to abolish the law or the prophets, but to fulfill. And what does he do with the moral requirements of the Torah? He takes them to a higher level. So he says, you heard it said, don't commit adultery. Well, I'm telling you, if you lust after a woman in your heart, sir, then you've already committed adultery in your heart. You've heard it said, don't murder. Well, let me tell you something. If you have hatred in your heart, then you're guilty of murder in your heart. So Jesus takes the moral requirements of the Torah to a higher level. That includes the prohibition against adultery and the prohibition against homosexual practice. Number two, in Matthew 15, Jesus says that sexual immoralities in the plural, the Greek word porneia in the plural, also Mark 7, sexual immoralities, in the plural, defile us. What are sexual immoralities? All sexual acts committed outside of marriage. You say, well, what is marriage? Ah, Matthew 19, in a dispute about divorce, Jesus explains that God's intention from the beginning was for the man and woman to come together and for the two to be one, joined together for life. That is God's intention. Soundbite answer. Number one, the argument from silence is dangerous. Just because Jesus doesn't mention something by name doesn't mean it's not important. Number two, in point of fact, he does prohibit homosexual practice at least three different ways, by fulfilling the law, by pointing out all sexual acts outside of marriage defile, and by saying marriage is the union of a man and woman only.
Cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I do hope you are enjoying this special broadcast on The Line of Fire. And please pray for me. We plan to have some exciting broadcasting later this week from the Philippines, where I'll be joining some of our fire leaders in a special retreat time with our missionaries that are coming in from different parts of Southeast Asia and our great team in the Philippines to pour into them. If you want to help, if you want to make a contribution to support us, go to the website, askdrbrown.org. In fact, you'll see a very special resource offer that we've set up there right on the home page, right on the first slide, and that will really energize and help us as we are in the midst of stretching out, running our race for the Master and taking the gospel to the nations. We are giving you simple responses. At the end of the broadcast, I'm going to summarize everything we've said, but simple soundbite responses for some of the major objections that are constantly raised in terms of our teaching on the Bible and homosexual practice. With regard to the idea that Jesus never addressed it, can I point out to you that as a first century Jewish teacher called by the honorific title Rabbi, he no more had to address homosexual practice than he had to address, is it right to catch a pig and bite into the pig while it's still alive and suck out the blood? You say, well, that's gross. I'm making a point that as a first century Jewish teacher, he no more had to remind people that the Torah prohibited homosexual practice than he had to remind them it prohibited eating of pig or drinking the blood of an animal. What's the point I'm making? First century Jews fully understood these things, and we have abundant literary attestation for how strong the rejection was against homosexual practice. Now, when it comes to just dietary laws, eating pig, eating shellfish, or something like that, I'm not talking about eating a living animal, it's just illustrating a point there. When it comes to just basic dietary laws, God gave laws to Israel to keep them separate from the nations, like dietary laws, but they were not universal moral prohibitions, whereas committing adultery was universally wrong for all people. Incestual relations were universally wrong for all people. Homosexual practice was universally wrong for all people. We covered that earlier in the broadcast. So Jesus addresses these things by saying that he didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill, taking the moral standards of the Torah to a higher level. He explains that all sexual acts committed outside of marriage defile, and he defines marriage as the union of a man and woman, and that was God's intention from the beginning. All right. Another objection that's raised, since we're talking about the beginning, let's go back to Genesis 2. God said, it's not good for the man to be alone. Some men are attracted to other men. God does not want them to be alone. He wants them to have a companion, a suitable helper. Soundbite answer. God was not simply giving Adam a companion, but a suitable helper, and it is only a man and woman who can come together as one by divine design and plan. Very simple answer. Now let me expand on it. The woman is called Isha because she's taken out of the man who is called Ish, and then the two come back together again as one. They are two same but different components of the whole. When Adam is created in Genesis 1, when Adam is created, humankind, it says male and female, he created them and he called them Adam, and then said, and made them male and female and said, be fruitful and multiply. But when we come to Genesis 2, we have Adam just as a male or just as a man, and now how he's alone. He needs a suitable helper. So God takes his tsela, which can be in rib or is normally translated side, and out of that, he makes the woman. So Eve comes out of man and what she called the mother of all living. Don't tell me that procreation was not important. Don't tell me that procreation was not part of the equation. Don't tell me that the divine design of male and female did not contain that fundamental plan of sameness and yet different. Why didn't God make Adam and Adam and have a seed and egg in both of them? Because there are fundamental differences biologically, spiritually, emotionally. And when the two come together as one, only those two can come together as one. Only female and male can come together as one. So when God says Adam needs a suitable helper, does that just mean to help him tend the garden? No. Does it just mean to give him a companion? No, it means also so the two can join together with the possibility of procreation, again, by divine design. It does not mean that every couple has to be able to have children in order to fulfill the divine plan. We understand that there are some couples that are barren, but it means that only a male and female make up the two necessary ingredients that fulfill the divine design. All right. Paul, this is what we're told. We say, hey, look, Romans 1, go to Romans 1, verse 24 to 27, that settles it. And Paul talks about male and female, sexual acts. They get so immoral, then it ends up men with men and women with women. Here are the answers that are given to us by gay theologians. Paul is talking about heterosexuals who get so inflamed with lust that they do what is contrary to their own nature and now give way to homosexual acts. Or Paul is talking about idolatry and sinful acts that are performed in idolatrous temples. Or Paul is only talking about excessive acts of lust. He speaks against all kinds of heterosexual immorality and then homosexual immorality. It is the excessive lust that Paul is against. Soundbite answer. In Romans 1, Paul teaches that homosexual acts are contrary to God's created order as laid out in Genesis 1. Did you get that? Let me repeat. Paul teaches that homosexual acts are contrary to God's created order as laid out in Genesis 1. Now, what about the idea that it's heterosexuals who do what is contrary to their own nature by engaging in homosexual practice? No, that's not what Paul says. He said it is contrary to nature, meaning God's created order. You say, well, Mike, how do you know that? Well, it's very plain. Paul does not talk about men and women as he gets into this, but about male and female. Now, that's a rare term in the New Testament. You'll find that Paul uses it, for example, in Galatians 3, where he's talking about in Jesus, that there's no class status, so there's no Jew, Gentile, slave, free, male, female. But when he's using it here, male, female, what's he going back to? Genesis 1, male and female, he created them. And then he lists some of the things that people have given themselves to, worshiping in idolatrous form, beasts of the field and various things like that. It's the exact language from Genesis 1. If you can read Greek and you compare what Paul uses there, the language he uses there, and then go to the Greek translation of Genesis 1, the ancient Greek translation called the Septuagint, there's no question. He's borrowing the language there. And he's saying that these acts are contrary to the natural order established by God. You say, but isn't he saying it's just excessive lust? Oh, he is talking about acts of excessive lust and passion. And by the way, it's undeniable statistically that homosexual and bisexual men are more promiscuous than heterosexual men, as promiscuous as heterosexual men can be. On average, bisexual and homosexual men are more promiscuous, which makes sense, as men tend to be more oversexed than women. If you have men plus men, it will not have the mediating effect or the moderating effect that a woman will have on a man. You say, but what about the fact that it's talking about idolatrous rites in the temple? No, it's not talking about idolatrous rites in the temple, but about the fall of the human race and how the human race, through its rejection of God, has been given over to other sins and other fleshly manifestations. And this is now a picture, as you read to the end of the chapter, of human sin and human brokenness and human rebellion, which manifests itself in a thousand different ways. But again, soundbite answer. In Romans 1, Paul is saying that homosexual acts, men with men, women with women, are shameful, and they are contrary to God's created order, contrary to nature as God established it in Genesis chapter 1.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you for joining us on this very special Line of Fire broadcast, where I'm doing my best to equip and help in a simple way in terms of giving soundbite answers to standard objections that are given to our understanding of the Bible and homosexual practice. And I want to urge you again, don't just take in the truth of what I'm saying, but pray for God's heart of love and compassion in the midst of your communications as well. If you missed any of the broadcast, it's all archived on our website. Within a couple hours of the show being over, you can listen to all of it. If you subscribe by podcast, you will get it. And it is one focused hour of teaching today. And you'll find it at AskDrBrown.org under latest audio. In a moment, I'm going to summarize the soundbite answers I've given you. And for the fuller answers, go to my book, Can You Be Gay and Christian? You can order it on our website. You can order it through any online book dealer, or you can get it at your local Christian bookstore. So for deeper answers, for more information, for lots of references, go to my book. For more full statements to the soundbites, just listen again to this teaching. What about the objection that in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 9, where Paul uses two words for offenders that will not inherit the kingdom of God, and otherwise he talks about those committing adultery, those committing fornication, drunkards, etc., he uses two Greek words, and gay theologians will often tell us, we don't really know what Paul was talking about, but it seems he was talking about men who acted in some effeminate, womanly way, and others who were exploiters of some kind, but it's clearly unrelated to homosexuals, and plus the word homosexual is a more recent word, so we shouldn't import it back in the Bible. Soundbite answer. While there is minor debate about the exact significance of these words, when used together, there can be no doubt that Paul is speaking against men who engage in homosexual practice. Simple. Now, should we use the word homosexual? Well, because it's used today, we can refer to homosexual acts. The word is used a certain way. We can now say, okay, let's take that word and use it to explain these acts, all right? But what's fascinating is that, and I have many of these sources listed in my book, Can You Be Gay and Christian? What's fascinating is that there are gay and lesbian scholars who say, no doubt about it, Paul proscribed all homosexual acts. Some will say he had a problem with it, he had an issue with it. Some would say, hey, that's Paul. Thankfully, we don't have to worry about Paul, and you know, they'll just discard it, and they don't have a high view of Scripture. But it's interesting to see how even gay and lesbian scholars realize you can't run far from this. So one word has the meaning of soft, a fundamental meaning of soft, and can be used for soft clothes or something like this. Hence, someone who is soft, the King James says, effeminate. And you say, well, does that mean, I mean, maybe a guy was raised by his mother and grandmother, he's heterosexual, but he seems effeminate the way he talks, his mannerisms. No, no, it wouldn't be talking about that. It would be talking about a man taking on a womanly role. You say, yeah, well, that's not necessarily homosexual, and maybe you're talking about a cross-dresser or something. All right, let's just say that could be debated. But when it is used together with the other Greek word, which is literally a compound word, in fact, Paul may have been the one to coin it, rather than using other words from the culture that referred to various acts of homosexuality, instead, Paul coins a term or uses a recently coined term in Jewish Greek from Leviticus 18:22 and from Leviticus 20:13 that talks about a man lying with a man. It's a compound word with a clear meaning. Just like in German, you have many compound words that form nouns. And what does it mean? Just look at the two parts. That's what they mean. That's how it works there in Greek. A man lying with a man. When you have the two terms together, as even gay and lesbian scholars have recognized, they are clearly prescribing homosexual acts themselves, not just pederasty, not just acts having to do with prostitution. In fact, neither word speaks explicitly of either prostitution or pederasty. And there are some translations today that put the two words together in one phrase to say men who have sex with other men. You know what's fascinating? If you look at the top dictionaries and lexicons, if you look at the major Greek lexicons, and because my focus in my grad studies, master's and PhD, was Near Eastern languages and literatures, and I especially got into lexicography, dictionary work, studies of the meanings of words, etymology, history. My doctoral dissertation was on the Hebrew word for healing in its ancient Near Eastern context. Since then, I've written a good number of word studies for major theological dictionaries. So because of my love for that kind of study, I accumulated a large library before the days we could get it on software, a large library. To this day, I have the books in my studio where I do radio surrounding me, all these different lexicons. And even though I am not a Greek scholar, I learned to do scholarly study of Greek words and Greek language as well using the major lexicons. And it's fascinating to see that the word in particular, which again is derived from Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20, speaking of a man lying with a man in Greek, that all the major lexicons through the decades have understood it to refer to homosexual practice. That is highly, highly significant, because many of the compilers of these dictionaries were not what we would call born-again believers or fundamentalist believers or those who had some theological axe to grind. And even if you're going to argue that they did, the fact is they were top linguists and simply looked at the word, the context, other ancient usage, and told us what they meant. So real quick, Leviticus 18, we're told that you can't say homosexual practice is an abomination. If you eat shellfish, no, God gave certain laws to Israel to keep them separate from the nations, and other laws were universal prohibitions, including this one. Well, Jesus never addressed it. Well, the argument from silence is dangerous, but in point of fact, Jesus addressed homosexual practice at least three different ways. Well, Romans 1, well, Paul was talking about heterosexuals getting inflamed with lust, becoming homosexual. No, he's saying homosexual practice is contrary to God's created order. And in 1 Corinthians 6, we can know for sure that Paul is using vocabulary to forbid homosexual practice. All right, get the book, Can You Be Gay and Christian, for a ton more information. Go back through the broadcast and listen some more. I'm sure that as you do, you'll find it helpful and fruitful. And partner with us so together we can reach a whole lot more people. To do so, go to my website, AskDrBrown.org. It's a way of you saying thank you. We want to stand with you. Go there and click on donate. My bottom line today, in the midst of all the controversy and confusion and questions about the Bible and homosexual practice, the word really is very simple and clear about all these things.